Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell, and if you know my husband Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Goodbye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.
This is a Hat Trick
podcast.
Oh, lovely.
Hello, Armin.
Hello, Jimmy.
So this week we have a request for what we're going to talk about from Paul Cartledge, Professor Paul Cartledge from Cambridge University. Now, I've known Paul for a while, and you were a pupil of his.
Well,
did he examine my doctorate.
He passed me, I'm pleased to say.
All right. Well, I'm really excited today because it's going to give us a chance to talk all about ancient Greek democracy and how that works, and a particular interesting debate that has a really exciting story attached to it. So take it away, Paul.
Hello, Jimmy. Hello, Armand. I'm Paul Cartledge, and I'm A.G. Levendy's Senior Research Fellow of Clare College, Cambridge, and a historian of ancient Greece. I think you both know me quite well. I've known Jimmy for a very long time and now work with him on Classics for All, an educational charity. And Armand, long, long ago, I co-examined your PhD thesis. So we're old mates on both sides. So I think what would be extremely interesting for you to discuss is the passage of Thucydides. Thucydides, the Athenian historian of what we call the Peloponnesian War. And it's a particular debate, and it's called the Mytilene debate in book three. And so what I think would be interesting for you to focus on are the questions of how authoritative is Thucydides' account? By which I mean, was he actually there? And if he was, why did he choose to report only two of the presumably several speeches that were actually made? So over to you guys. Bye for now.
Well, that sounds like the kind of exam question you might set in an Oxford paper.
Yes, it's it's quite a daunting challenge. I think we'll get on to that.
Yeah.
But let's take a step back.
Yeah.
He's thrown at us the Mytilenean debate. So where are we and when are we?
So this is the city of Athens in the 5th century BC. It, at that stage, is at war with the Spartans and their allies. And the island of Lesbos, on which the city of Mytilene is the main powerful central city, is one which decides to secede from the Athenian alliance.
Now, just let me stop you there. What was the Athenian alliance? When was it all set up?
So what happened was that after the Persian Wars, the Greeks decide to set up a league, an alliance, to keep the Persians at bay should they ever return.
What was it called?
At the time, it was called the Delian League, or we call it the Delian League.
Because it was
League.
Set up,
it was
on,
set
the
up on the island of Delos, which was neutral. It was the Switzerland of the ancient Greece. And that eventually, because the Spartans, who were the other big power, were somewhat timid in the sense that they didn't really like to get involved in alliances and that sort of thing, they left the scene to a degree. And the Athenians, who are very aggressive and forward-looking, become the dominant element in that league.
And can I just ask you a question? Sparta couldn't be more different to Athens, could it? I mean, in terms of their cultures and their prowess on land and the Athenian prowess on sea. So whilst they're together, they are actually 1 and 1 equals 3. But at this point, it was a cold war that turned into a hot war, wasn't it?
That's what happens in the course of the 5th century BC. Yeah. So the Spartans were concerned that Athenian power was getting too great. And so it leads to hot conflict in the 430s.
Called the Peloponnesian War.
And that was called the Peloponnesian War. Sparta is on the island, on the peninsula of the Peloponnese.
Which is like a world, I mean, it's like a world war. I mean, by our standards, it's a small war, but it's that whole Mediterranean is now in conflict.
Absolutely. So what you have is all the different city-states. Remember, these are independent city-states. So independent states, Sparta is independent, Corinth, Thebes, other elements of the Greek world, which are scattered around the Aegean islands, like Lesbos and Samos and so on, are all involved on one side or another. So it is a bit like a world war.
So Mussolini decides, we've had enough of Athens telling us what to do and providing them with ships and tribunes. We want to secede from the Delian League. Are Mussolini a democracy like Athens, or are they a different setup? Are they an oligarchy?
So we're talking about Athenian democracy, which is a very unusual constitutional setup. And Mussolinians or other city-states around the Greek world, and there were about 1,000 of these, have their own different kinds of constitutions, most of which are not democratic in the Athenian sense. So they will have leaders of their cities, they will have small groups, so they will be called oligarchies. On the whole, Athens tried to impose democracies in those cities and say, look, we're a democracy, we're the greatest, you should also be like us. It managed in some cases, it didn't in others. Those who were democratic tended to side with Athens. Those who were more oligarchic tended to go on the other side.
Can you just explain what oligarchy originally meant? Because it obviously might mean something different these days.
When we talk about oligarchy in the ancient Athenian context, what we're talking about is essentially something that is opposed to the democracy, because demokratia is the power or control of the demos.
Lots of people.
That's right.
And the crassy bit is the rule, isn't it?
It's the rule. So
aristocracy.
Yes. Yeah. Or ochlocracy.
Kleptocracy. Like you have in Russia and maybe in America now. Yes.
There we go. Oligarchy is the arche, the rule of the oligoi, which means the few.
The few.
So all oligarchy really means the few people who are at the top of the tree in Athenian society are in charge of government.
Because these days there is a kind of pejorative patina to it, where you say, oh, they're oligarchs. Mm. There's something quite nefarious about this. But in those days, it was just a neutral description of a way of governing.
Yes, I mean neutral, except that from a democracy.
Well, it depends if you're a democrat or not.
Yeah, they thought that oligarchy was a bad thing because it meant that the few are ruling in their own interest, as opposed to in the interest
of... So it's pretty similar to the way it is now.
Except that I think there's... today, when we talk about oligarchs, we think of billionaires.
Yes.
And although the oligoi, the few in Athens, would have been equivalent of billionaires, one isn't thinking of them so much in terms of their financial or economic status as in terms of their political power.
So describe to us how the Athenian... Because we kind of project onto Athens, it gave birth to democracy. But their democracy was a bit different to the one.
Very, very different. So, I mean, look, where was democracy born? When was it born? Okay, this is what is generally believed, that there was a tyranny in Athens. So it was run by the so-called Pisistratids. Pisistratus was a tyrant in the 6th century BC. His sons inherited his tyranny, Hipparchus and Hippias. Hipparchus was killed, and then Hippias became very tyrannical and eventually had to be expelled by the Athenians. He went off actually to Persia in 510 BC. Then there's a kind of three-year interregnum where Athens is without a leader, but it has all these powerful aristocratic clans, two of which then decide they want to try and become dominant. One of them is led by a man called Isagoras, the other by Cleisthenes. And famously, Cleisthenes decides to bring the people, the demos, onto his side. This is what we're told by an ancient source. And as a result, he wins out. But he does this in a very clever way. He says, I will reform the way Athens is run. So it has four tribes. He says, we're going to turn this into 10 tribes. Those 10 tribes will not have sort of clan loyalties like the old ones. There'll be some elements of those from the city, some from the shore, some from the inland areas. So he actually divides up Athens into 10 sections.
Like cantons.
Yes, cutting across traditional clan loyalties. And these then become the 10 tribes of Athens, or of Attica. And so he then says, we are going to be equal under the law. So he doesn't use the word democracy at this stage. We don't get that. What we get then is a new constitution set up by Cleisthenes in which you have equality under the law. So that's the crucial thing, that the male adult citizens are equal under the law.
So no women are voting.
So no women, I'm afraid, and no slaves. And there are a big slave population in all these Greek cities.
So it's a minority democracy, really.
It's a democracy, but for those people who are entitled to vote.
Yeah.
And that's about 20% of all the people.
It's the Orwellians. All men are equal, but some are more equal than others.
Yeah.
And how many people are we talking about, roughly?
It's hard to tell, but we think there are something like 20 to 25,000 adult male citizens, but maybe 250,000 individuals as a whole in Attica, including, obviously, let's say if there are 25,000 men, 25,000 women, say, so you get 50,000, their children and their slaves, and some of them would have had two or three or many more slaves. So you get a very large population of people.
Yeah.
But
I mean, Athens was by far and away the most
populous,
of the cities. I mean, the average city-state was a couple of thousand people, wasn't it?
It could have been as small as that, maybe 2,000 to 5,000. Yeah. Yeah, it depends.
So Athens is huge. And the executive, we say like our houses of parliament that we have an executive that's voted in, the MPs are voted in, and the ones who have more MPs than the others, they get to legislate. The others are in opposition. What was the setup in Athens for those kind of people who are permanently in session waiting for things to debate? Because we're going to get onto the debate in a minute.
Okay, so well, we have to remember that this is what's called a radical democracy, which means that you don't have representatives. We have representative democracy in our modern cities because, of course, we have millions of people. Mm. We can't all turn up and vote. Mm. But there they could.
Right, okay.
So a radical democracy, a direct democracy, is one where the citizen voters literally turn up, and they would turn up on the Hill of the Pnyx. It looks as if there was a quorum. You had to be about 6,000 to pass legislation. Mm. That's called the assembly. The ecclesia in Greek is the citizen assembly, and that makes the decision.
And who would organise it?
That is the members of the council. They're called a boule. Mm. There are 500, and they are chosen by lot. And that's a really interesting system, the idea that you choose the people who are going to set the agenda by lot, because you don't want bias and prejudice. So there's this incredible machine, which we have found, and it still exists, and you can see it in the Athens National Museum, called the Kleroterion, the machine that decides who gets elected. And it's all done by vote. You know, little balls go in and they, by lot, people turn out as the...
So that's very fair. That's a kind of...
Well, yeah, and in fact, the idea of sortition, as it's called, is being considered even today as a fairer way of running a democracy. How do you elect the people who are going to make the decisions that will then lead to the proposals that can or cannot be passed? Well, lot is one way of doing it.
So you're painting a picture. There's a hill called the Pnyx.
Yeah.
And the organising body, the boule, call a debate. And they say, we have a problem. Mussolini, we've heard, is revolting. And it's seceding from our Delian League. Yeah. We need to debate this. What actions are we going to take? And then they gather the people up on the Pnyx. And then what happens? What's the agenda then?
And then what happens is that those people who are for and against a particular proposal debate it.
Right.
So in this particular case, you had two politicians, one of whom we know very well, called Cleone.
Cleone, yes.
Who was the sort of loudmouth, who was the...
A demagogue.
The so-called demagogue, yes, someone who was supposed to have spoken extremely roughly.
Did he cloak himself in the I'm just a bloke kind of...
He was a bloke.
Like a Nigel Farage of the 5th century.
Yeah. So he gets up and he says, we need to destroy these Mytileneans.
Right.
Root and branch. And the person who speaks against him in that particular set of speeches is called Diodotus, and we know nothing about Diodotus, except he says, and interestingly, he doesn't say, no, no, we can't do that because it's not right. He just says it wouldn't be politically sound to destroy them, because then other people might think we're a very cruel and ruthless leading.
He's a more moderate voice.
He's a more moderate voice, yeah, but still talking about pragmatism, not
but
about morals.
Thucydides talks about the fact that there were two debates, debate on day one and the debate on day two. So what happened on day one? Who won the debate on day one?
So Cleon wins the debate, and the Athenian assembly votes to destroy Mytilene.
And how would they do that in those days?
Literally by putting their hands up.
No, how are they?
Oh, I see.
Armand, I'm not stupid. I know how they vote. I'm moderately stupid, but so once they've said yes, let's go and destroy them.
Yes. Okay. So they send.
What's the system? Because they have a system, don't they?
Yeah, they send the triremes, the ships, to subdue that island.
And the job is to put to death.
To put to death all the men.
All the men of arm-bearing age.
Yes. To enslave the women.
And children and old people.
And to then give over the land to Athenian settlers.
So it's almost a mini genocide.
Ethnic cleansing genocide, you name it.
And it was called a clerarchy, was it this thing?
The clerarchy are the settlements on the island, yeah.
Yeah. So this is quite harsh.
This is what they vote for, a harsh punishment of Mussolini.
And then they all go home. I mean, they've done their voting.
As you say,
the direct democratic action is yes or no. Do we do it or we don't do it? We do it. This is what we're doing it. It's a black and white move. It's not a nuanced debate in that sense. It's we're going to teach them a lesson and pour encourager les autres.
Yeah.
This will go around the empire saying, if you mess with us, this is what happens.
Absolutely. And this is one of the arguments that Cleon uses. You know, if we don't do this, everybody will revolt against us. And I think in this case, it's about sending the orders to local garrisons and saying, destroy Mytilene.
Right.
So what we're told, I think, is that a trireme was sent out to Mytilene.
That day. Wow.
To order the destruction of that city-state. But the Athenians sleep on it and they think, oh my God, maybe this is not the right thing to do.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
So as they're going home that night,
yeah,
and they start talking to their friends and family, they start to think, have we... Because clearly they were furious.
Mm.
Cleon's whipped them up. I'm trying to picture this scene. He's whipped them up into a frenzy. It's a bit like a rally, isn't it? He's suddenly got them make Athens great again kind of thing going.
Yes.
And they're furious, and it's a show of imperial strength. Then they go home and they calm down.
And they come back the next day.
And they want to.
The second assembly.
They want to open the debate again?
Yes. And they have another debate.
And how would they do that? They say, we want to debate this again.
One of the key things about the democratic system was that any citizen could raise a debate.
And you'd walk up the hill again?
You'd walk back up the hill.
It's good for your steps.
Oh, yeah. They're very fit.
Yeah. Diodotus. He steps up. And Thucydides. Now, so this is the great. You know, Thucydides at work here, he gives us speeches, which clearly, would he have been there? Would he have witnessed these?
So, I mean, this is a question that Paul's asking.
Yeah,
I mean, so how do we know?
Because we finally got to one of Paul's questions.
Two speeches on, you know, on either side.
Yeah.
Some people have argued that Thucydides was present at some of these events. So, famously, the Periclean funeral speech that he reports. I mean, it sounds if he might have been there. Some have argued he was. But Thucydides himself says that he'll report the kind of thing that was likely to have been said at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So he gives himself a let out. We don't have to assume that he's actually been there. He might have heard about it. He might have been present for part of it. In this particular case, I think what Paul's getting at is that the debate is given to us on the both sides of the debate. We have Cleon's speech, we have Diodotus's, and it's more formal than you might expect in an actual assembly. Mm. It's not something that would have happened simply like that in such a neat fashion. So it's as if these cities are saying, well, here are the two sides that would have been argued.
Mm.
Cleon for complete destruction, Diodotus for some clemency. Though, I mean, in fact, the clemency that he argues for is not total, you know, and the punishment was still execute the leaders of the revolt,
but not
a thousand of them.
But not eradicate the whole...
Not eradicate the whole city, but dismantle their walls, confiscate their fleet, take control of the island.
And Cleon makes a point, doesn't he, about, you know, it's important to make decisions, even bad decisions. You stick with them. You kind of, to use a modern expression, you double down.
So that was Cleon's response. He said, look, you know, we can't vacillate.
Because the ship's gone now.
The ship's gone. We can't, anyway.
If we change our minds, we'll look weak.
Well, that's what he...
We double down. We just keep on going.
Yeah. Right. But the Athenians, at that stage, decided that they did want to change their mind. They vote for Diodotus's.
And Diodotus does a very clever rhetorical technique, because doesn't he say, I'm not here to talk about whether, you know, we show pity
right
or mercy
or
justice. Mm. And by saying he's not going to talk about it, of course, he's now talking about it. So he plants those ideals, which were in some way quite close to the Athenian heart still.
Oh, very much so, I think.
I think the whole thing about xenia and being hospitable, and there was a kind of spirituality to that. And so they then decide to do what? Which is, this is why, when I first came across this when I was a student, it was such an exciting kind of story.
This is a tremendously exciting
story. Oh my God, what have they done now? And then what do they do? Because this is the extraordinary
thing.
So
they have to send out a second ship, a trireme, to try and overtake the first one and make sure it doesn't get to the island and order the destruction of it before that order can be countermanded.
Yes.
And so
they've got to row a lot more quickly.
They have to row basically 24 hours a day. They have to, you know, have the resources and the food.
I'm imagining a scene where the first one is going, is that one of our boats? God, they're going quick. Oh, my God, they're going quickly. And they pull up alongside going, no, stop.
Stop. That's exactly what happens. They
don't
actually
kill anybody. It's all off.
That's exactly what happens. They get there just in time, apparently. Or at least that's how Thucydides tells the story. They get there just in time.
A governor's reprieve.
Yeah.
Wow.
Like, no, we changed our mind. The assembly changed its mind. And so the Mytileans, well, you know, the irony of it is you think, oh, hooray, they've been saved. But of course they haven't been saved. There's still been 1,000 men executed and all sorts of horrible things happening.
I can't help thinking about Brexit. I can't help thinking at this point that the whole direct democracy, the referendum.
Yeah.
A referendum is that you ask a yes and no question about a much more complex matter, and you end up with an answer which is basically, you know, a lot of people now have buyer's regret around that.
Well, yes, but I also think that the problem is that you have a largely, often quite uninformed voting body making decisions. Mm. And this was something that philosophers like Plato...
He didn't like democracy.
He didn't like democracy for that reason. These people don't really know what they're voting for, and it's easy to whip them up.
Mm.
So if you're a good orator, you can get people to vote for X or Y. They don't really have any understanding of the deeper issues. But you might be an unscrupulous orator and get up and ask them to vote for something, such as the destruction of a city-state, and they'll just vote for it because they're whipped up by you.
But the democratic system is a system whereby politicians are not bribing, but they are cajoling, and they're appealing and manipulating and constantly aware that they need to remain popular with the people who are voting them into power.
Yes. So if you come up with one very popular idea, it's possible that people vote for you, though there are lots of other things that you stand for that they don't really want.
Which I think you do see in America right now.
Well, I think that's what's happening, you know. Make America Great Again, for example. Mm. You know, yeah, everybody wants to do that. So you vote for the person who, at the moment, seems to be making America far from great again.
And yet what we're seeing now is that they have this system of town halls where the congressmen and the congresswomen go back to their constituents and have these town hall sessions where they're accountable. And the advice now from the upper echelons of the Republican Party is to stop having them, because the kickback they're getting a real kind of reaction now. They're standing up and be accountable for what's happening. And people are screaming at them. People who voted for them are actually screaming at them, saying, we don't want Social Security cut. We don't want Elon Musk going around with a chainsaw cutting away all these different pillars of our democracy. It is, be careful what you wish for.
Yes.
But his banner, the Make America Great Again, and Cleon, similarly, is we are
Athens. I do
think
of him as a kind of Cleon,
But this is fascinating, isn't it? Yeah. That Cleon to Trump, there is a direct line.
Yes.
And Farage, and all of them. These are demagogues, and they're not stupid people.
Yeah, but let me just pick you up on one thing, which is this idea of accountability.
Yeah.
Because that was something that was baked into the ancient democratic system. Yeah. You had to be reviewed after your term of office. So there was some check on what officials and those in power did. And that was seen to be a very important administrative aspect of the democratic system. But another very unusual check on the possibility that someone would become too powerful was something called ostracism.
Explain that.
So this was a mechanism whereby if the demos thought that an individual was becoming too powerful and dangerous, they could arrange for a vote, which meant that you could put that person's name on a pot shard, which is called an ostracon in Greek.
It's a little tiny bit of pottery.
Basically, you smash bits of pottery and you have these little shards of pottery. And these are given out and you write a name on it to say this person should be ostracized.
That's where we get the word from.
That's where we get the word from. And if you had a sufficient number, and I think it was meant to be 6,000 of these counted, then that person would be sent into exile for 10 years. And we know this happened to a few politicians. Famously, one of Pericles' opponents, a man called Thucydides, like the historian, but actually Thucydides, son of Milesias, was his conservative opponent in the 430s. And people thought, he's getting too powerful, and they ostracized him. So you then have to go from Athens to another city-state for 10 years. You're not allowed to return. A very clever idea.
But was it fair? I mean, isn't it open to... I mean, we've seen recently in Turkey, you've seen the mayor of Istanbul being imprisoned on so-called corruption charges, but it just so happens he's also the main opponent to Erdogan. Mm. I mean, isn't it a system that's open to...
It is totally open to corruption. And the great thing is that a lot of these ostraca have been found.
Oh,
and guess
with
what?
Names on it.
With names on them, such as Themistocles, such as Thucydides. And guess what? A lot of the writing is the same. So somebody has
up all
been,
night just
yeah has been writing
fixing the vote.
I mean, you could say, look, a lot of the Athenian peasants were basically illiterate,
so needed someone to write for them.
Yeah, put his name down on the ostraca. But of course, it's quite possible, isn't it, that you could just have your own store of ostraca and decide this person I don't like, he's my political opponent, and get that sorted.
It's interesting you mention exile, because the reason we know so much about the Mytilenean debate is because the great historian of the age, Thucydides, he was actually sent into exile himself, wasn't he?
So Thucydides was exiled from Athens in 424 BC.
He obviously upset somebody.
Yes, I mean, he was actually a general, and he was assigned to defend Amphipolis, which was an important Athenian colony in northern Greece. And the Spartan general Brasidas launched a surprise attack. Thucydides didn't arrive in time with his fleet, and the city had to surrender to the Spartans. And the Athenians blamed Thucydides for this, and they sent him into exile for 20 years. So thank goodness for that, because during his banishment, he was able to travel throughout Greece, including the territories controlled by the Peloponnesians, and get a lot of information from both sides of the conflict to write this extraordinary history of the Peloponnesian War.
Because he has another very famous tract in his history, it's called the Melian Dialogue, where that was another similar incident to the Mytilene incident, but they don't behave as well, do they? They carry out
They really do, but that's later on in the course of the Peloponnesian War.
Yeah.
Melians, again, they had been neutral. Athens demand that they join the Athenian alliance, and they refuse because they want to maintain the neutrality. So there's this Melian dialogue. And again, someone like Paul might say, how does Thucydides know what was said?
It's a bit like a play, isn't it? Because they've each got speeches. And I have a quote here from one of the speeches of the Athenian saying, it's the law of nature, the strong will prevail and the weak will suffer.
All the adult men are executed. The women and children are sold into slavery. The island is settled with these clerics, these Athenian settlers. I mean, horrible. Brutal behaviour.
But there's a comeuppance a bit later on, in, was it 416, they decide to do the same to Sicily.
Ah, they vote to conquer the island of Sicily.
Yes.
Yes, indeed.
Because they're on a roll now. I mean, they're kind of... Right, okay.
And this then leads to a three-year campaign, total disaster for the Athenians.
I mean, the Athenians assumed it would take a few days to...
That's right.
It's a bit like...
3 days, yes,
it's a bit like Putin and Ukraine.
A special expedition.
Yes.
But it turned into this three-year slog, ending with the destruction of the Athenian army. And there's a wonderful book that's just been written called Glorious Exploits, which talks about the Athenians in the quarries in Sicily. You know, 6,000 Athenians are penned up in the Syracusan quarries, and they die under terrible circumstances. You know, terrible heat in the day, terrible cold in the night, and they die of thirst and hunger. I mean, awful. It must have been terrible.
Wasn't there a story that some men were saved by being able to quote?
So that's what Glorious Exploits is about. The Sicilians were really keen on the latest music of the theatre. So, of course, in the theatre, you had choruses who sang Athenian choruses. And so Athenian theatre, they say, what's the latest? And, of course, the latest was Euripides. And so they said, do you know any Euripides, apparently, to some of the Athenians who were penned up? And those who could sing bits of Euripides, they'd pluck them out and they'd save them and they'd give them food and water. And some of them made their way back to Athens, we're told, and they went to thank Euripides for saving their lives.
Wow, that's a lovely story.
Yeah, because they could actually sing some of his lyrics.
And delight their captors, and they stayed alive. So that's an incentive for anybody knows. Studying for GCSE or A-level is to get stuck into your Euripides.
Learn your texts. Could save your life one day.
You never know. So they kill 1,000 Mytilenean leaders. They take down their walls and they take away their ships. Does anything else happen to Mytilene itself after all that?
Yes, I'm afraid it's a sad story. The Athenians chopped up the land of Mytilene, and they gave it to Athenian settlers. They called them clerics, people who were allocated a certain amount of land and settled on what used to be the land of Mytilene.
And what about Cleon? What happened to him?
So he is very keen on showing his own military prowess, and he leads an army up to Amphipolis in Thrace, and he gets killed
there. Oh. What a shame.
That's in 422. And that actually leads to peace breaking out for a bit, the so-called Peace of Nicias in 421. So in the middle of the Peloponnesian War, there is a small period in which the main fomenters of war, Cleon on one side, his Spartan opposite, his name is Brasidas.
Brasidas, yes.
The two of them die in this conflict, and it leads to the possibility that peace can be made. But the peace that struck in 421 is unfortunately very quickly violated by Athens and Sparta.
Well, as we can see today, it's very, very hard to come up with the terms upon which a ceasefire and a peace is sustainable, isn't it? It relies on both parties actually adhering to those agreements.
Yes, and if there are lots of people involved, as there were lots of different city-states, then you might decide there's a peace between Athens and Sparta, but then Corinth and Corcyra and all these other places might still be fighting their own local battles.
Well, Armand, thank you. This has been another fantastic series, sitting here with you, learning all about the ancient world. So do you think when Paul Cartledge hears this, he'll give us an A or a B plus?
He's a very, very sharp examiner. I'm sure he has lots of ideas. He's actually written about the Mytilene debate and whether or not Thucydides was present. So everybody needs to go out and read his paper on that.
Okay, all right.
It's All Greek and Latin to Me is presented by Armand Dangour and Jimmy Melville. The producer is Digory Waite and the executive producer is Claire Broughton. It's All Greek and Latin to Me is a Hattrick podcast.
Hi, everyone. I just wanted to give a mention to Classics for All. Classics for All is a charity, and what we want to do is provide access to the classics to as many state school pupils as possible, alongside training teachers who don't actually have to have any previous training in the subject. They hope that they make classics a sustainable part of the school curriculum. If you want to find out more about this fantastic charity, go to the website. It's www.classicsforall.org.uk.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.